This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Dr. Simon Quilty serves patients in one of the hottest places on Earth, Northern Australia. Just last year, his patients in Katherine, Australia, suffered through 54 days where temperatures were above 40 degrees C or 104 Fahrenheit, above that. Dr. Quilty estimates during hot weather, about half the people admitted to hospital were pushed over the edge by heat, and some die. But on death certificates around the world, there is nowhere to record heat as a contributing factor like that. We know tens of thousands can die in a single heat wave, like the one that hit Europe in 2003. We know more people will die as global warming delivers even more record temperatures. But we don't know how many because, for a variety of reasons, we don't really count heat deaths. From Alice Springs, Australia, Simon Quilty, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Just to set the stage here, as a kid I watched a TV show filmed in Australia called The Flying Doctors, and it kept coming back, a new version in 1985, and then in 2008, Bush Doctors, a reality TV series. Simon, have you been a flying doctor for remote communities?
Yes, Alex, I have. I've working in a place like Katherine in the Northern Territory. So Katherine region is the size of France, and it only has 10,000 people living in one town, and then mainly Aboriginal people living in extremely remote communities. The only way to get around effectively is by aeroplane, and I must confess that some of the most scariest moments of my life have been flying through huge tropical storms in 40-year-old aircraft. It's definitely a lot of fun.
Sounds like some of the exciting bush flights that happen here on the coast of British Columbia, where the weather can change on a dime. So I think, Simon, some parts of Northern Australia may be like a lab where we can study extreme heat coming to most of the rest of the world due to our greenhouse gas emissions. What do the patients you see complain of as they arrive during periods of very high heat?
Yeah, well, look, let me firstly set the scene of where my patients come from. So I've described that it's in the tropics. If you watch Crocodile Dundee, that's the country that movie was actually filmed in. And in fact, a lot of the scenes were in and around the township of Katherine. So it's incredibly hot and there's a lot of poverty. Aboriginal people are incredibly left behind financially, economically, socially, and culturally. And I guess your suggestion that we use that it could potentially be a laboratory is a really interesting way to frame how I see the problem. So a lot of the research that's been done around heat and death has been done in subtropical and temperate regions. And there's 2 billion people living in the tropics of the world. And one of the interesting opportunities of understanding heat in a region like the Northern Territory of Australia is that it is a high resource setting with incredibly impoverished people. So we have access to some really fascinating data that can really help us understand how people are dying from the heat. But going back to your question, what do the patients complain of in this extremely hot weather? So as a doctor, what I see regularly is extreme heat really driving people into hospital in waves. So in the tropics of North Australia, the environment is divided into seasons where we have the hot wet season where it rains a lot, and then we have the cooler dry season. So we don't have heat waves so much as heat seasons. And in the hot weather, we refer to it as mango madness or going tropo. It's a really intense period where the heat starts to affect biology and behaviour. And so in terms of the biology of how this heat impacts people, it decompensates particular diseases. It also transforms the whole ecosystem. So, for instance, the crocodile attack victims that I've treated have been treated at times of hot weather. The snakes are more active. So it becomes quite a crazy season. And when you work in a hospital that's in a non-tropical environment, you get used to this tempo of work that is the same throughout the year. And maybe when in the colder weather, you get more influenza and respiratory illness. But the tempo of tropics is very distinct. It's the hot and wet weather and the dry weather, and it really flavours everything about the work as a doctor that I do.
In November 2017, Radio EcoShock guest Camilo Mora described his paper titled 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You. So it's not just heat stroke or sunburn or something. Talk to us about the processes you see where heat drives other existing conditions into hospitalization or even death.
So, Alex, obviously, for anyone that's visited the tropics, you'll understand that heat can kill directly. And so when you live in a place like Castron, you realise that you can only spend about 15 minutes out in the sun in the middle of the day before you can feel your whole body decompensating. And that's somebody that's fit and well. But in terms of the processes that are more likely to kill people, so when you live in a tropical environment, everybody is very well aware, and even parking your car and walking to the shops can be a bit of an ordeal. But if you have underlying health conditions, then they can absolutely be decompensated by that walk through the heat to the shops. So cardiac failure, you can imagine your heart's pumping. If it's not pumping as well as it should do, then that heat stress will make you evaporate more. It'll mean that your heart has to pump harder. And a lot of the medications that we use carefully balance the fluid inside people. And when you get a really hot period, that can push you over the edge. Really extended periods of extreme heat can damage kidneys. And really interestingly, I'm working on some research at the moment that's demonstrating that it has a very significant impact on mental health. So you can imagine, particularly for Aboriginal people, that but all people in the Northern Territory, it turns out, the chances of taking your own life and committing suicide in extremely hot weather doubles compared to cooler weather. And we're in the process of trying to prove exactly what this association means. But you live in the tropics and you don't have good resources to shield yourself from environmental extremes. Hot weather can really precipitate impulsive behaviour. One of the things that I've noticed as Aboriginal people come to terms with the extreme impact of climate change on their environment is possibly also an existential grief as they see the environment destroyed by climate change and they have no power in which to respond to that. So heat can affect people in many ways in a biological and psychological capacity.
Yes, you see, I think you are teaching us something about the future of the world as we warm. And you've just talked about the mental health impacts and the feeling of grief as we lose this environment. It's horrible, but it's inspiring because now we can see what is coming.
Well, yeah, Alex, so you did point out that issue of using the Northern Territory like a lab, and that's entirely my intention over the next few decades. This problem is not going to go away. So, for instance, in your introduction, you described that we had 54 days above 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Over the last two decades, the temperature in the Northern Territory has increased on average by 2 degrees Celsius, and inland Central Australia is increasing at the most rapid rate of all. The long-term average of days above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 40 degrees Celsius in Australia, is 6. And last year we had 54 days above 40 degrees Celsius. And this is the new norm, but only for a short period because it's going to get much worse as the climate heats. So the only thing that we can do is understand it as best we can to learn how we can adapt and certainly how we can mitigate, which is the absolute imperative at the moment.
Dr. Mora also told us about the harvest effect, where the deaths come in days or even weeks after the heat wave. Does Australia have a heat warning system for outdoor workers like farmers to avoid exposure during heat events?
I haven't read Dr. Mora's research, but what she's talking about is what I would term a lag effect. And the international academic literature tends to suggest that there's not a lag effect from heat so much as cold. However, I think most of these academics live in southern or further northern climates that are cooler. than where I live in Central Australia, and there's no doubt that there's a lag effect. And I'll put it this way. So one of the fascinating things about the north of Australia is its ancient Indigenous people. There's over 40 different languages still spoken today by Aboriginal people that have had connection with the land for 60,000 years, and colonisation has been quite cruel to these people. And so you can imagine nowadays they are now experiencing heat that has never been experienced before, and the infrastructure that they have is meagre and it was inappropriate 20 or 30 years ago when it was built, and it's simply not prepared for these new climate extremes. So you can imagine if you have a period of 21 days above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which we had last year, your building starts to warm up, your air conditioning costs skyrocket. When you don't have much money, you run out of power cards to keep the air conditioning going, and you experience a blackout and power failure because of your economic stress. All of the contents of your fridge go off, and this is by day five. And so what you suddenly have is a competition between energy security to cool your environment down and your refrigeration and food security. And there is no doubt that there's a lag effect with heat, and we have a lot of work to do. So your question was, does Australia have a heatwave warning system? This is a state-by-state basis. In the Northern Territory, we do not have a heatwave warning system, and there's a real problem here. Because we live in a tropical environment, it's already been estimated by academics that up to 75% of days in the Northern Territory, it is inappropriate to work outside. The Northern Territory has the greatest outdoor workforce of any state in Australia. And so having a heatwave warning system is extremely problematic.
Right. Every day is going to be hot for a long period of the year. Now, with lead author Thomas Longdon, you just published a paper in the prestigious journal, the medical journal, The Lancet. And the title is Heat-Related Mortality, an Urgent Need to Recognize and Record. But why don't we begin with Tom Longdon's earlier work in the Climatic Change Journal in September 2019. What did Dr. Longdon provide that helps track real heat deaths?
Yeah, so there's some very complex epidemiology and statistics, and I'll brush past them by saying that basically we understand that on stable temperature days we have a standard death rate. And what we know is that as the heat goes up, so does the death rate. So between, say, 20 and 25 degrees Celsius for most parts of the world is when we experience the least deaths. And what we do know is really cold climates, like the north of America and Europe, when it is really cold, you do experience an increase in deaths. But for the 2 billion people in the tropics, and this has been the focus of attention and what Tom Longdon really argued against in his paper in 2019, it's not cold weather in the tropics that kills people, it's the hot weather. And so Tom has done some very, very sophisticated modelling that shows that heat-attributable death is really much higher in countries like Australia than previous mechanisms and approaches to modelling suggested. So it was really important research that highlighted the dire consequences of heat, particularly for the 2 billion people that live in the tropics.
So when it comes to heat deaths in Australia, what is the official number of people dying due to heat according to the count of death certificates?
So in our recently published paper in The Lancet, we looked at all deaths between 2006 and 2017. There were 1.7 million deaths, and of those deaths, only 300 people were recorded to have died as a direct result of heat, and another approximately 300 people associated with heat. So less than 1,000 people were recorded on the formal mechanism of recording death, which is the death certificate, which you have the same process in the US, when in fact our modelling and Tom's modelling suggests that in fact that number is closer to 40,000. So we're only detecting roughly one in every 50 people who are dying from heat. So you can imagine with coronavirus, if we were only detecting one in every 50 cases, we'd be in an awful lot of trouble.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Simon Quilty, a practicing specialist physician calling in from Alice Springs in Australia's outback. We're talking about extreme heat hitting Australia as an example of the coming hot world. During this COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen lots of countries find ways to undercount deaths from the virus. In Russia, they only listed people who showed the disease in autopsies, and you can imagine they didn't have time to do a lot of autopsies. And the U.S. didn't count nursing home deaths until recently. And some countries downplayed the disease, so they didn't want the real death count known. Do you suppose that reticence to attribute deaths to heat could be related to government reluctance to admit the seriousness of climate change?
Look, there's no doubt that certainly in the US and Australia, our federal governments are heavily influenced by lobbyists from coal, oil and gas. And our entire economies are built upon coal, oil and gas. And in Australia, that is very much a political reality. However, in this new era of conspiracy theory, I think what is really interesting about the coronavirus is that it is an absolute biological reality, and as scientists and doctors, we not only do we know how to predict that the disease will affect people, but we look after these people in their dying days. There's no argument against reality. And so what we need to start doing very rapidly is recognizing the real risk to future generations, and I believe that in the next 20 to 30 years, climate change and global warming is going to make coronavirus look meek in comparison in terms of its impact on humanity.
Yes. Well, perhaps medicine and governments are stuck in this one-dimensional way of thinking. We demand the cause of death rather than the complex ways that bodies do break down and can't recover. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I think one of the fascinating perspectives that I have working with Indigenous people in the north of Australia is an understanding of human beings as ecological beings. We are part of a complex ecosystem. And one of the problems with the death certification process and the way that governments try and have this one-dimensional way of thinking about death is that it's describable in terms of its organ cause, as if it's removed from the reality of the ecosystem. And certainly, you know, as urban beings, so we forget that we're urban beings, and the Aboriginal people that I work with remind me every day that we are, in fact, ecological beings, but we're withheld in the construct of an urbanised world. And so we're much less likely to recognise that. And it's interesting, you know, if we count deaths by immersion in water, we call that drowning, and that's very visible and easy to see. But if you start to try and attribute death to heat, it's actually much more complex than that, and it's a hard job to actually define heat-related mortality. But in big part, that is because once a person comes into a hospital, they're in an air-conditioned environment, and we as doctors forget to actually mark down on the death certificate that heat was instrumental in this person's demise.
Simon Quilty, what are you and other Australian doctors recommending as changes to the way deaths are recorded?
So, look, I think that across the world it's recognised that the death certification process is very antiquated. It's a piece of paper with a series of catalogue spaces to record how this person demised. In this modern day where we have electronic records, it would be really helpful. You wouldn't necessarily even need to say that heat was attributable. It would be good to record on that electronic piece of paper the amount of air pollution, the temperature and other environmental factors so that we can start to get a grasp and we can start recognising the impact of the environment in terms of human health and well-being.
The other odd thing about official heat mortalities is we can't really use them as a gauge to how much the climate is warming, because in Northern Europe and North America, heat deaths may have decreased somewhat, not because it isn't hotter, but because the authorities reacted to shocking numbers dying, as they did in Chicago in 1995, for example. And they instituted social changes to cope, like cooling centers for the poor and the homeless, and India reduced heat mortalities that way. It kind of hides the real dangers of increasing heat up to a point, doesn't it?
Yeah, so look, I'll give you an example of the real dangers of heat. So in Katherine last year, we had the hottest summer ever on record, and this is over the last decade. There's been two or three summers that are record-breaking, and there's record-breaking weather all of the time. In December, we had a month that was 5 degrees above the long-term average. It was around about 106 degrees Fahrenheit on average for the month. And a whole lot of billabongs dried up. Aboriginal people have ancestral stories that are much more accurate than you might predict. So there's stories, for instance, in far north Queensland of volcanoes erupting, and when geologists have looked at the dates of that last eruption, it was over 20,000 years ago. And so when an Aboriginal person tells me that their water hole has dried up because it's never been so hot ever before, I tend to believe that they will know better than anybody else. And so it's quite possible that in the last summer, we had the hottest summer ever in the last 65,000 years of human habitation in Australia. And that was very clearly demonstrated to me ecologically. So Katherine is obviously a very wild town with nature all around for many, many hundreds, if not thousands of kilometres in any direction. And there's these beautiful big trees along the riverbank called bush apple trees. They're massive trees. They're all hundreds of years old, and they provide all of the green foliage along the river corridor. And last summer, I watched as just about every single tree died along the river corridor that I could see. And it's not through lack of water. These trees have their roots in the riverbank, and the river is permanently full. And so I can only presume that they died as a direct result of an extraordinary heat and unprecedented heat wave that must predate processes of ecological adaptation over the last 60,000 years. And so humans cannot be immune from such massive ecological change.
Simon, why did your team include bushfire deaths in a study about heat mortality?
Well, we feel that a lot of ecological variables that are new and unprecedented are not being recognised for the health harms that they do. And so I'm sure many of your listeners would have heard about the devastating bushfires we had on the East Coast this year. It's truly unfathomable how much of the country actually burned. And across Australia, all the way out into Central Australia, the entire atmosphere went an eerie orange colour. And closer to the bushfires, there was dense, thick smoke throughout cities and towns everywhere. And once again, there's no formal way of recording these deaths. And it's because we are now living in unprecedented times where this stuff hasn't ever been encountered before, and we need to be measuring it.
In addition to the large-scale heat maps employed by Longdon, we also find temperatures much higher within cities, the urban heat island sort of thing, and some of them are never recorded. For example, on Radio EcoShock, we spoke with Dr. Matt Santamouris, and he's a professor of high-performance architecture at the University of New South Wales. And Matt was measuring local heat within cities, and a drone carrying heat-measuring equipment discovered 158 degrees Fahrenheit, 70 degrees C, on an upper-level car park in Darwin. If somebody moves from an air-conditioned office into that kind of heat, could that bring on medical problems, or does it take us a while to soak up and build up our core temperature?
Let me tell you that similar studies have been done in Darwin in children's playgrounds, which have found exactly the same thing. In fact, I think they were even hotter. I've treated people who've had epilepsy and had a seizure and fallen on the ground and had third-degree burns as a result. And for anybody that's walked through a car park when the ambient temperature outside is 49 degrees Celsius, which it reached here in Alice Springs last year, you'll realise that from a physiological point of view, there's a very limited time before you will cease to be alive in that kind of temperature.
And we know the world is warming pretty rapidly. What is your team's estimate for the death toll in Australian cities by 2080, well within the lifetimes of young Australians now?
Yeah, look, so CSIRO did some interesting research back in the early 2000s, and they predicted an increase in temperature by 2 degrees in many parts of the Northern Territory by 2030 and up to 7 degrees by 2070. And it's very clear already that these are significantly underestimating the true speed of temperature increase. And so we're already there. We're already at 2030 predictions 10 years early. So I imagine that by the year 2070, we will be seeing temperatures up to 60 degrees Celsius or 130 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, by that stage, you are talking about an uninhabitable space. Air conditioning will not be able to compete with temperatures that are that high. And vast swathes of the Earth will be potentially uninhabitable unless we take urgent action on climate change to reduce carbon emissions and to move towards a carbon negative economy so that we prevent that from happening. It's impossible to predict under those kind of circumstances how many people will die. Many people will die as a result of migration, homelessness, wars and famines. But if they weren't to happen by some miracle, then you could predict. So we predict that roughly 2% of people die from heat at the moment. I presume from some early data that we will see an exponential rise with every 1 degree in temperature rise of heat waves. And so we could be looking up anywhere above 10 or even 20% heat mortality, particularly in tropical environments.
This is a giant, slow-moving heat pandemic. Did your team extend your analysis to the United States? And if so, what did you find?
We haven't extended to the United States at the moment. I'm just aware that the US and many parts of Europe have similar death certification processes.
Okay. Now, is there any other message as we wrap up here that you would like to leave with our listeners?
Look, everybody can see that climate change is real. There is some very complex political messaging coming from coal, oil and gas. Climate change is a devastating reality for people in the tropics. It's already arrived. People are already dying from extreme heat that are a direct result of climate change. We're all in this together. We need to unite. We need to change the way we live dramatically, and we need to start recognising that for us to propagate generations into the future, we must take more heed of our commitment and our resolve to care for our planet.
From the front lines of heat in Northern Australia, we've been speaking with specialist physician Dr. Simon Quilty. In addition to serving in Northern Hospital, Simon is a visiting lecturer at Australian National University and a fellow of the Royal Australian College of Physicians. Find links for this new paper on the need to recognize and record heat-related mortality in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Simon, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thanks very much, Alex. Much appreciated.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.